And good morning, everyone. It's Saturday morning once again in the Land of Enchantment. Last day of the week, last day of our show until Tuesday morning. And we're going to wind up the week with a really extraordinary show. I mean, I've tried to do themes, I've tried to do arcs, I'm trying to kind of come back to certain ideas and flesh out with more detail certain discoveries and certain innovations that we are encountering in this journey that we're all doing together. And this morning's guest is going to absolutely knock your socks off. But with all due respect, before I get to him, what I need to do is to fill in a couple of things that kind of were left hanging last night. Because if any of you, you know, remember the show, and it was, what, 24 hours ago, which you should, we had a bit of a problem. I had my guest, Paula Harris, discussing her involvement with, various people over the years that have done major activities, major research, major revelations in the what is colloquially called the UFO field, and actually should be broadened to include kind of ET activities or ET involvement or ET research. And then kind of a lot of weird things happened. One of the things that happened is that she got cut off twice during the show, and we tried to reestablish contact. And when we tried, including both numbers, both a cell phone and a landline, we couldn't get through. And so we played music, and we frantically dialed numbers, and we frantically flipped switches, and finally we got her back, and we moved on in the conversation, and then it happened again. And what had happened during the entire show before this abrupt cessation of conversation was that her line kept being interrupted by call waiting, and because I didn't really think that she knew instantly how to disable call waiting, and I didn't want to try to instruct her during a live show with the danger of losing her, etc., I kind of just let it go because it's kind of easy just to ignore, you know, a second or two gap here and a second or two gap there. But this, whoever was calling like persistently every few minutes throughout the entire 2 hours. So at the very end of the show, we all sign off, and I suddenly noticed that her icon on Skype disappears again. And because I was very concerned that there was something going on besides some whatever, I tried with Scott on the other line to reconnect, and we tried, and we tried, and we tried. We tried for half an hour after the show, and finally, I left voicemails on all her numbers. Finally, she answers one of the lines, and she said, "You're not going to believe what's happened." She said, "Both my phones were dead. I haven't gotten any messages, and somebody killed my internet." And we spent some time talking about the context. Remember, yesterday was a red letter day in this field of study, in that for the first time in modern American history, and I'm talking now probably 100 years since the works of Schiaparelli and Lowell and those people who actually published in journals their perceptions that maybe we weren't alone, and there was evidence through the telescope of canals on Mars, and that indicated some kind of advanced civilization. Well, for the first time since all that took place, like a century, there is a major mainstream scientific paper being written, even as we speak tonight, and it will be published, and proposals are being put in to various observatories, radio observatories around the world, for funding of a search, of a radio search directing the telescopes to look at this distant F3 star, slightly more massive and slightly bigger than the sun and slightly hotter, which is located roughly 1,500 light years away in the direction of the constellations of Cygnus and Lyra, because over the last 4 years, NASA's unmanned Kepler Space Telescope has been seeing the most remarkable, the most bizarre, and unique, I mean, in a world where that word is totally overused, a unique signature of eclipses of something or some things, because there appears to be more than one, orbiting the star in a very long period of time and blocking out at times the light of the star, not by 0.001% or 0.01% or something like that, but up to 20%. 20% of the light is being dimmed, and then is coming back in a few days or a few weeks. I forget the exact number. So the astronomers who've been working on this project, they put all this together in a peer-reviewed paper, which has been published in the scientific literature and has now been promulgated around the world in media, mainstream media, all over the planet. I mean, I've been counting the number of stories in Yahoo every day, and it has never dipped in the last few days below two or three, and at some days there are five stories in different major media covering this remarkable discovery with the headline, "Astronomers Find Possible Alien Civilization Around Distant Star." And the idea is that the things blocking the starlight, the objects that are causing the eclipses, could in fact be massive pieces of alien technology orbiting the star, and we're in the plane of the orbit, so every time they sail around on our side of the star, they come between us and the star, they block the light dims by 20%, which, folks, is staggering in terms of astronomical measurements. And then it resumes again, and then the object is moving off into space in its orbit, moves around, and then it comes around again on a regular periodic orbital frame. The fact that a mainstream paper is being composed and mainstream proposals are being written to follow these observations by Kepler up with actual radio telescope observations looking for signals, I said last night, was perhaps the beginning of the endgame. A number of us, a number of researchers you've heard on this show and on many other shows over the years, on Art Show, on George's show, and hundreds of blogs and podcasts, have all discussed the possibility that we are not alone, that there's evidence that the scientific community is either seen and has self-censored, or has seen and has ignored because it's just too beyond the edge of the paper to be believed. This is the first time, again, in 100 years, where a bona fide, legitimate proposal that we're looking at some extraordinarily advanced ancient civilization has been formally proposed, widely discussed in the mainstream, and nobody's laughing. So that was a prelude to my discussion with Paula about the U.S. government involvement with UFOs and extraterrestrial potential technology that's coming here, and the whole rest of the story about what might be hidden. And it was in that context, particularly when she got to the part about the Canadian Secretary of Defense, or Minister of Defense, as they call him, who served in the Canadian government co-equal in time with Robert McNamara, who was our Secretary of Defense under John Kennedy. And the context of all that was that, you know, we had discussed earlier in the week, we discussed Iron Mountain, the report from Iron Mountain, which basically said, and documented now that it's a real report because it shows up in the CIA debriefings or papers, you know, debrief papers of the presidential daily briefings for Lyndon Johnson in October of 1967, that in fact this somehow is all connected. The fact that, you know, UFOs and ETs have been persona non grata for decade after decade after decade, but behind the scenes... Well, let me quote one thing from Iron Mountain that our friend Lu Sheehan sent me tonight that he wished we'd quoted in the show a couple of weeks ago. This is directly from Iron Mountain. Remember, the Iron Mountain report was looking for alternatives to war, to global war, and they looked at several other possibilities, including the possibility of a vastly expanded space program. This is the quote. By uniting mankind against the dangers of destruction by creatures from other planets or from outer space, experiments have been proposed to test the credibility of an out-of-our-world invasion threat. It is possible that a few of the more difficult-to-explain flying saucer incidents of recent years were in fact early experiments of this kind. Remember, this is the report from Iron Mountain, a direct quote. Continuing. If so, we could hardly have been judged encouraging. We anticipate no difficulties in making a need for a giant super space program credible for economic purposes, even were there not ample precedent. Extending it for political purposes to include features unfortunately associated with science fiction, i.e. UFOs, flying saucers, would obviously be a more dubious undertaking. So, in that context, what happened to Paolo last night, which was unprecedented in the history of this show in terms of actual assaults on a guest, well, as Paul Harvey used to say, you now need to know the rest of the story, because when I got up today, first thing I did was call Paola, and she was there, and she assured me that she'd sent several emails, she was okay, but there were further developments from the show. Apparently, whoever was assailing her in the call waiting, repeated calls, called her repeatedly all throughout the night, again and again and again and again. And this continued throughout the day, and she was not looking forward to this evening because obviously she needs to get some rest, get to bed, and she couldn't disconnect the phone because she has to, for family reasons, remain in touch. So she was kind of between the proverbial rock and a hard place, but it does not end there. She then told me that whoever had disconnected all of her systems, and I asked her, do you have, like, one-stop shopping? Is your email and your landline and your internet and your cell phone all with one carrier? And she said no. Three separate carriers. Comcast is her internet. I forget what phone company is her landline. And Verizon is her cell phone. And someone was able to take down all of those independent systems simultaneously, instantly, and keep them off until this morning, except for the phone that rang and rang and rang all night. Then she said something else that was even more mind-boggling. She said in the middle of the night, she began to get calls from someone else complaining on her answering machine that her phone was ringing them and waking them up. So whoever took control of her phones used it as a third-party diversion and pulled in separate people around the country as nuisance calls in the middle of the night and into today, using her phone as the springboard. Now, this to me is kind of over the top. It is consistent with the pattern of obstruction and destruction and censorship and harassment and attack and any other kind of deleterious activity you can imagine that's gone on around this field for the last 50, 60, 70 years since this broke in public esteem and acclaim back during the years of Roswell. And I said to her, why would you think that of all the shows that we have done, they would pick you to single out, not the show, because, you know, nothing happened here, and Keith assured me that nothing had happened at the network at our end, that all the problems last night were associated with her comm systems, with her phones. I said, why do you think they singled you out? And she said, Richard, I'm beginning to believe that we may all be very close to something, something that's going to blow everything wide open. And I said, yeah, I mean, to me, this is an indicator that we're winning. Now, the reason I bring all this up is because what I haven't wanted to talk about in the last several months is behind the scenes, before this all erupted into the open last night, this show has been subjected to extraordinary outside pressures. All kinds of weird things have gone on. People wonder why I'm not having fun. It's because I've been spending like 24/7 keeping the ship afloat with every possible assault and attack underwater, like torpedoes, coming at it to derail it, which up to and includes things like emails that were sent that never arrived. Paola in the afternoon had sent us several sets of images to be posted, as we have images tonight in Radio with Pictures, and they never arrived. I had to sit here manually doing everything with them, send them on to Keith and Rich so they could be posted, and hours would go by and nothing would be sent and nothing would be received. And so this has been going on for a very long time. All kinds of other things, guests that suddenly drop out after they've agreed to be a guest on this show, and they just kind of leave you hanging. In fact, that's why I had to turn to Paola yesterday, because guests that we had previously scheduled simply suddenly had better things to do. I'm telling you all this because if we ever just suddenly disappear, if our show just suddenly disappears, I want you to be very, very suspicious. Some of you on Monday night when I was not on, and I was not on on Monday night, Tuesday morning, because I frankly didn't feel well again. So we ran Peter Lavenda. A number of you sent emails saying, are you okay? I really appreciated that set of emails because it means you're watching. Ladies and gentlemen, please keep watching. And on that note, I want to segue to someone who I think has had similar experiences in the a professional career of his great-great-grandfather, or is it great-grandfather? We will sort that out when I bring him on. He is Mr. Jack Churchwood, and let me read a few notes, and then we will go to the evening's conversation, because in the context of an ancient, extraordinarily advanced extraterrestrial civilization, not at a distant star 1,500 light-years away, but in fact in this solar system with ruins left all around, which I discuss in my latest iteration of our research in link number one under Radio with Pictures, that's the Pluto book that was published this spring, where I basically have not only predicted the idea of what we would find in terms of ancient artifacts around this star, but also the extraordinary discoveries that we are now finding at Pluto vis-a-vis the larger advanced ancient Type 2 civilization model. So that's why link number one is up there. So let me get to tonight's guest. Jack Churchwood served 6 years in the U.S. Navy, going on to earn his bachelor's degree in electrical engineering from the University of South Florida. Jack has over 30 years' experience in the aerospace and defense industry. In addition to earning the rank of Eagle Scout and participating in archaeological digs as a youth, Jack is a fourth-generation engineer and fourth-generation patent holder and identifies himself as a Tibetan Buddhist. Jack's research into the life and theories of his great-grandfather, well, that answers that, James Churchwood, author of the books about the lost continent of Mu, is conducted using his technical expertise, unique connections, special viewpoint, and access to a portion of James' original source materials. Armed with this knowledge and capabilities, Jack seeks to create a more complete understanding of James Churchwood's theories and ancient advanced civilizations. Jack, welcome to the other side of midnight.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I guess you haven't had that kind of an intro before.
No, I haven't. Sounded great.
Okay, let's back up. How does a Navy... My dad was in the Navy. He was in the Seabees. He built stuff. I guess maybe that's why I have this predilection for people who build things and seeing stuff that's been built. What part of the Navy were you in?
I was in anti-submarine warfare.
Aviation
anti-submarine warfare.
Exciting and dangerous, and that must have been a trip.
Well, it was service. I had 3 years in Bermuda and a year in Keflavik, Iceland.
Radically and different temperatures.
Absolutely. And I was stationed at the what they called the Tactical Support Center, and we briefed and debriefed the P-3 crews that went out and tracked submarines.
Oh, the P-3 Orions.
Correct.
So you were not always on land or on a ship. You weren't ever in a submarine yourself.
I was not in a submarine, no. I got to fly on the P-3s sometimes, and that was fun.
Oh, I'll bet that was. So then after you left the Navy, you decided you needed a degree in something, and you went into electrical engineering. Was that because of your experience with ASW?
Well, yes. They had trained me as a technician. And after – when you see that the engineers aren't any smarter than I was, then I realized that all I needed to do was get my degree.
You got to get the piece of paper, and then they'll take you seriously. It says here that you were involved in archaeology as a kid. Obviously, I mean, we got to get into your great-grandfather. What was it like growing up with a very famous guy in your family tree?
Actually, it was – I didn't realize that he was a famous guy.
Oh.
Some individuals occasionally and well, actually quite a few people have come up to me and asked me about him. And whenever I would go – when my father was alive and ask him, he was very dismissive.
Oh, really?
And, well, he lived with my great-grandmother, and they were separated, as it were.
Okay.
And she did never, ever say any good things about him.
Huh.
And So essentially that was my viewpoint for quite a while, until I started my research almost 10 years ago. And I had decided that I would take on a different approach rather than just completely dismissing everything he said, mm-hmm. and using all the information that I was told from my family, that I would take an honest look at what he wrote and look into his background and some of where his theories were formulated. And that's what my research is at on my website.
Okay, well, if we scroll up, excuse me, to the top of our website tonight, othersideofmidnight.com, and we look at link number two, there's a picture of your great-grandfather there wearing this really interesting boutonniere. And you know, it's so eerie, because when I saw your picture this afternoon when it came in with your bio, for a moment I thought that I'd gone back in time, because you and he look eerily alike. Eerily.
We might be related.
Has anybody ever told you that?
Yes, my wife says it sometimes.
And I took a quick glance, you know, the suit you're wearing, it almost looked Edwardian. It almost looked like, oh my gosh, it's you know. Anyway, be that as it may, so how did you wind up going from electrical engineering, and obviously you had some kind of a career, you know, in the intervening years, how did you go from that to being intrigued enough to actually begin to dig into your great-grandfather's legacy?
Well, actually, I do it in my spare time. It's not, I'm still got the day job as an engineer.
Okay.
From what I'd heard...
How does one, by the way, let me interrupt, how do you write a book in your spare time? I've written two, and believe me, it's full-time work, at least it was for me.
Well, thank God, at least for me, the baseball season's over, and I have a little bit extra time now to... No, when I was going to school...
Wait, I got to stop you again. Do you think the Cubs have a chance?
No opinion.
Oh, come on.
It's Joe Maddon, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a Rays fan.
Oh, so okay.
I know what Joe Maddon can do.
Okay. I just figure it's been such a desert so long. I mean, don't they deserve karmically, because you're a Buddhist, don't they deserve karmically to kind of get back there at some point?
It depends upon what their collective karma is.
Ah.
But for Joe Maddon, I wouldn't put it past him.
Okay. All right. Sorry I interrupted, but I'm baseball. Come on. I had to ask that question.
Absolutely. I had, when I got my email address, jack@churchward.com, mm-hmm. I started getting a lot of emails. Are you, and people asking me questions. And so that fostered initially to try to figure it out. Then I met... an individual who was a good friend, Percy Tate Griffith, wrote a biography of my great-grandfather in the year after his death. And his daughter...
When did he die, by the way? I forget.
1936.
Oh, because I think we have a picture from that year. I think that's the picture at the top of the page, taken in 36 or 35, something like that.
This one came with an advertisement, I believe, with the... with the publication of the 1931 Children of Mu.
Oh, okay.
At least I clipped that portion off the bottom before I sent it in.
Okay.
So I met his daughter, and she was very interested in my great-grandfather's theories and had worked for the ARE in Virginia Beach.
Hmm.
And we spoke, and she gave me a copy of his, a typewritten copy. I mean, just a copy of his biography that they wrote, that her father had written. So that, and a few years later, I was contacted by an individual who had run across his scrapbooks. And so I paid the man the money and received those, and I started to look through those as original source material. And from the emails that I got and some of the things that I've witnessed, I... was under the understanding that it can't all be baloney.
Why would you even approach it like any of it was baloney? Was it because it contrasted so sharply with the conventional archaeology and timelines and all that we're all taught in school and college and all that?
My father wouldn't even mention his name. When my grandfather died, even though my great grandfather was alive, he wasn't even mentioned in the obituary.
Oh.
So
there was kind of like a family veil. We don't mention the unmentionable.
Exactly.
Oh,
they didn't want to have anything to do with him.
As a Buddhist, does this not tell you that maybe there's something else going on for you to be led individually by yourself back to what he was looking at?
My curiosity, rather than Buddhism, drug me in that direction.
Okay.
I mean, people would be writing, wrote me questions, and I didn't know the answer. I just write them back and tell them the same thing that my father told me, and they weren't very happy about that. So originally, some of my original work perhaps was a bit negative and looked like I was only a skeptic.
Okay, when you say original work, what original work are we referring to?
Well, I mean, when I started getting emails, I just tell them the story I'd already been told.
From your dad?
Yes. And then after a while, like I said, about 10 years ago, I decided to take an unbiased approach and just look at the information, given my technical skills, look through his source materials, look at his life, and does it all match up?
If your family was so negative about your great-grandfather, how come there was any source materials left around the house for you to find?
There were none.
Where did you find them then?
An individual approached me because obviously I had my address on the line, and he picked up my address and sent me an email and asked me if I'd like to purchase them. And I had the funds at the time and was lucky and was able to purchase them.
So what would you say was your granddad's or great-grandfather's major heretical idea that everybody wanted you not to take a look at?
Oh, I don't believe that anyone has really approached me there. Lost my great-grandmother's tea plantations in Sri Lanka due to gambling and womanizing and drinking and bad investments.
So you mean their perspective was not based on his research, it was based on the man and the things he did not do as a family man in consonance with the Victorian early 20th century idea what a family man should do?
Yes.
Okay. So I'll tell you what, why don't you hold it there, because we're at the bottom of the hour. We have a break coming up. I obviously want to get into, you know, exactly what you found in terms of his research and his results and all that, and we'll do that after we come back. My guest this morning is Jack Churchward, great-grandson of the James Churchward. Did I say Churchward? I meant Churchward. And as you can hear in the background, the theme of this morning is looking at archaeology from another perspective. You're on the other side of midnight. My name's Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Jack Churchward, and we were just about to get into the good stuff, which is, what did you find that was valid about your great-grandfather's work? First of all, why don't we lay out what his thesis was, and then we can go into the details. I'm kind of getting myself ahead of myself.
Well, James Churchward believed that while he was in India, he had discovered certain tablets. He called them the Nikal tablets from the priesthood that kept the ancient knowledge of the Nikals and the higher civilization of Mu, what he called it, M-U, as opposed to M-O-O, which Le Plongeon wrote about. And his What he discovered in these tablets was that there was an ancient advanced civilization in the Pacific. Now, okay. Actually, there were no, I do not believe there were pictures in there to tell him exactly where the continent was, but he wrote that it was in the Pacific Ocean. I don't know that they gave him the size, but he wrote that there were 64 million inhabitants and that they provided the culture and civilization for the rest of humanity as they left their Pacific Island homeland and populated the Earth.
Okay, if you go to everybody, othersideofmidnight.com, Radio with Pictures, and the way you get there is you click on othersideofmidnight.com, that takes you to the splash page, click on tonight's guest, Jack Churchward, that will take you to his page. Scroll down to image number 3, graph number 3, and there is a map. It says Colonel Churchward's map of Mu. And, Jack, if you want to kind of narrate, I mean, he proposed, I guess, a whopping big continent in the middle of what is now the world's largest ocean.
Correct. And I'm not sure that I'm totally agree with the fact that there was a large continent in the middle of the Pacific. I think our geological evidence indicates that it's not a very high probability that there was a large continent such as that.
Well, we know so much more geologically now than he knew, but in terms of his database, in terms of state of the art then, he could logically, and I guess in his mind, propose that there was this large place where civilization had been distributed in a diaspora to the rest of the world. Was that basically it?
Correct. But his understanding was that there were Archean gas belts under the Earth, and these collapsed. And with Mu sinking, it also raised all the mountains at the same time.
You mean the mountains around the Pacific Rim?
Mountains all over the world.
Oh, okay.
That's what raised the mountains, the magnetic cataclysm, I believe he called it.
Okay, so he was looking at a global cataclysm and the disappearance of one of the major continents. It would have been the eighth major continent, of course.
Mu and Atlantis at the same time, he believed.
Okay, and so the time frame was what, 12,000 or so years ago?
12 to 13,000 years ago.
Let's skip ahead and then we'll go back. What is your alternative geologically to explain the idea that there was an aboriginal race, an advanced race somewhere in the Pacific?
Well, I would go farther to the south and east. I would go down near the Indonesia, north of Australia and New Zealand.
You mean south and west?
South and west, yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. So could those islands, that archipelago, you know, Indonesia strung out like pearls north of Australia, could that be the remnants? See, I don't know. I know when Flight 70 disappeared, there's a lot of new, you know, oceanographic stuff being done to look in that part of the world. They moved that over to the Indian Ocean now. But is it possible that there was more land at one time that could have been populated and it has, in fact, sunk for some reason?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I'm absolutely know that the coast of Asia was a lot farther out.
Ah, so you have the underwater data now that he did not have.
A lot of people have the underwater data to show that there was an enormous, I don't know that you would call it a continent, but obviously a lot of it's underwater now.
And the explanation for it disappearing is what, sea level rise?
Right, after the last ice age.
Ah, okay.
And that perhaps that there are or were evidence there that we just either we can't get to or it's been obliterated, not like evidence that is now being found in Africa and, you know, up in, well, all over. We're finding ancient humanoids and all over and finding their information and being able to track it back to that area and the time period.
Well, you're obvious. Go ahead.
And unfortunately, there are areas that are now inundated and we don't have access to them to be able to find the evidence.
Are you familiar with the Yanaguni ruins?
I have been apprised of them several times, yes.
And you've seen the underwater imagery and photographs and all that?
Correct.
Huge, geometric, massive formations, structures, whatever, that the naysayers say, oh, that's just nature, and the positive guys say, wait a minute, you know, civilizations create right angles, nature does not create that kind of incredible geometric complexity on that scale. And I take it you're in the latter camp.
I believe that there are natural processes that perform some of that sculpting.
At Yonaguni?
Correct.
Okay.
But to say that, you know, there's a turtle figure, how did that get carved? That's probably not very natural.
And there's a huge face with a headdress. I've actually seen a photo, a color photo, of a diver hanging weightless in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that, nature wouldn't do that.
Probably not.
Have you followed the work of Graham Hancock at all?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Graham has found a set of amazing ruins offshore, off India, that apparently he dates at about the same time frame, 12,000 years, and they've been covered now by sea level rise. I would presume in the model that there's a global connection to these ancient cultures of the same time frame, that might be part of the same mythos. Would you not think that might be possible?
Well, James actually wrote about them.
Oh, okay.
He wrote that he had seen these ruins. You could see them, I guess, as the boat passed by.
Oh.
And he looked down and saw them.
Oh. Because mainstream archaeologists now are totally poo-pooing and dismissing, and it's weird. It's really, really weird. So, okay, let's go back to the linear story. You get intrigued because of emails and people noticing the church ward name. In looking at your great-granddad's research, apart from his reputation in the family, and obviously you were impelled to continue because you found something that basically said, oh, this is interesting.
Well, for instance, you have the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the Bible, and James uses that in one of his books to describe his interaction with the Rishi who had imparted the knowledge of the Nicol tablets on him. And one of the things that the Rishi had done was to place a burning coal in James' hand, and while he held his hand, telling him that he raised the vibration of James above that. And James wasn't burned, obviously, but he took out the coal. The Rishi picked it up and put it in the pot and then asked him to light his cigar off of it, which obviously lit up rather quickly.
Mm.
But he wanted to show that there were other masters and that were able to control themselves and do feats like this. And so James mentions that it was the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego hearkened to that they were masters of what the Nicols taught. Now, fast forward a few years, I'm hosting a visiting lama, a Tibetan lama, and we've got stuff in the oven, and he opens up the oven, reaches in, grabs it, and puts it straight over onto the counter.
Without an oven mitt.
Without an oven mitt, doesn't scream, doesn't yell, and didn't drop it on the floor.
Hmm.
And another occasion, I watched him reach into a burning stove, you know, the old antique burning stove in the house, and he was moving the wood around.
Oh, okay.
And I mentioned to him, and I said,
without a poker.
Yes, and I said, you might want to show everybody all this. And I'm just, and those are just two things that I've encountered that caused me to not say everything was a bunch of hoo-hee.
So, okay, let me get this straight now. Because he had given testimony that these apparently superhuman feats were capable of being duplicated now, you felt that his reporting of them then gave credibility to his archaeological perspectives in terms of ancient advanced cultures.
Well, it just brought to mind that I can't throw everything out.
Okay.
That I need to look at it point by point if necessary, and evaluate that in an unbiased manner. Rather, like I said, just rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Okay. So where would you say that you differ from him? I mean, we've already discussed that you don't think there was a giant continent that sank, that the reference to an advanced civilization in that part of the planet is due to maybe a lot of land that's now been submerged by sea level rise along the coast of Asia. What other departures from, well, again, let's go back to his model, his proposition. He's talking about an advanced civilization. Why was it termed Mu? I've always wondered, why is it called Mu? Is that short for something? Is that an acronym?
From he never mentioned Lemuria.
Okay.
But if you take the L-E off and R-I-A, you have Mu.
So how do we get from Mu to Lemuria? Who made that leap?
Well, Lemuria predates, the theory of Lemuria predates Mu at least 50 years. Schlachter first came up with it as a method to explain the distribution of plants and animals around the Indian Ocean basin.
Okay.
And from there, Madame Blavatsky took it and put it into theosophic writing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people went from there. The book by Philos, I don't exactly remember the exact title, but he wrote about the fact that there were the advanced civilization under the Mount Shasta, and then they came from Lemuria as well.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that your dad, your great-grandfather contracted Lemuria to Mu, is that what happened?
No, actually, what he said is that is what the Rishi told him from the tablets.
So the original name was Mu, and the other names were later noise added to the concept.
I believe that's the case. He also believed in his writings that Atlantis was a colony of Mu.
Hmm. And what did, in terms of concepts, what did the name Mu stand for? Or did it stand for anything?
It was the motherland.
Okay. So we can go like to Ma, Mu, that kind of phonetic association?
I haven't gone there.
Okay. All right. And see, these are questions everybody who's not followed any of this is probably thinking, you know, where names are important. We name things when we grow up because that's identifications. Names have meaning. So what did the name Mu mean? But if you haven't pursued that, obviously it's nothing that I will pursue. So let's move on. So again, in terms of your great-grandfather's research, what other parts did you think actually were worth looking at?
Well, the fact that I've actually seen people, another thing that caused me to continue my or start my research was the bog bodies in the Wendover Bog on the east coast of Florida.
Oh, you mean in that very deep lake?
No, there wasn't. It wasn't. They were in a bog, and they were doing some construction, and the backhoe driver hit a skull and called in the police, and they eventually found a huge burial field, and there was actually DNA. They had the brains were kept in the skulls.
Okay.
And they were able to take DNA from them, and the DNA didn't match anybody currently living in the U.S. I mean, it didn't match any of the Native Americans.
So the Seminole tribe, I think, is there.
Yes, but they moved from up north. They were previously several other, the Timaquans were here that were wiped out, and then the Calusa.
Oh, you live in Florida now. That's right. Okay.
Correct. And they were wiped out, and they had some amazing structures. The Calusa did in South Florida.
When you say structures, you mean architecture?
Canals.
Oh, okay.
And they did a lot of aquatic fisheries and things like that. But they had extensive canal works down in Southwest Florida.
Hmm.
So the fact that they found an individual who from, I believe it was 5,000 BC, living in Florida, that wasn't related to any of the other Native Americans, just struck me as, well, where did these folks come from?
Hmm.
That wasn't the real thing that got me. The discovery of a teenager with spina bifida was the real thing that just said, well, who are these people? This child would have had to take daily care, and you would have had to devote people to his or her care for 12 or 13 years that they lived. But the child had a severely debilitating disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so how could primitive people take on this responsibility when, you know, they weren't suffering for survival?
In other words, they had the surplus economics to devote to keeping people who could not be self-sufficient or were actually a drain on the culture alive and well cared for and, you know, basically kept in the community as opposed to just let die.
Exactly.
And you based the idea that they had to be an advanced culture so they would have the economic surplus to allow them to do all that.
Absolutely.
Then you said, well, where did that advanced technology to give them the economic surplus come from?
Exactly.
Yes, and then you said, go ahead.
and then I said, there's got to be more to this. I mean, where did these folks come from?
Why didn't you think they were just indigenous and just kind of bright? I mean, a lot of people around the world have built canals and they built water structures. I mean, look at South America. Look at the Anasazi in the American Southwest. I live in the middle. The Hohokam are a stunning culture, and we don't think they came from someplace else. At least our mainstream archaeology doesn't think so for a very, very long time. I mean, they're talking about the land bridge and all that. But you know, I mean, 7,000 years is kind of like, in archaeology terms, kind of just yesterday. Or was it the uniqueness of this culture in that part of the continental United States that made you kind of wonder where they came from?
Well, that was a definite consideration. But also the fact that their textiles, they've discovered textiles in the burials that they'd never seen before.
Now, the bogs, kind of like the peat man up somewhere in Europe, I remember when I was a kid reading a National Geographic article, scared me to death. The cover had this leathery, you know, mummified guy on the cover, you know, surrounded by the nice yellow border of National Geographic. And I remember really for days having nightmares about this guy, you know, rising out of the bogs, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the acidity or the lack of whatever, you know, the kind of tanning properties of the bog that preserved the bodies for 8,000 years?
A lack of oxygen.
Ah.
It was a peat bog, I believe.
Yeah, well, that was the same in Europe somewhere, England or wherever they found this. It was a peat bog.
Well, they buried them in the bog, underwater, and they were held down with a small structure.
Hmm.
And as the silt filled it up, it entombed them.
Now, did they? This is a complete sidetrack, and you're not probably going to know the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Did they do this as a pattern, a cultural pattern, because they didn't have a lot of dry land to bury people on, or did they do it because they knew it would preserve the body?
I don't think either. I think they had plenty of land.
Okay.
They had plenty. I believe they had plenty of land around there. But I mean, the sea level, the water would have been a little, at least a little lower. But yeah, there was plenty of for them. But I don't believe that they, I mean, they did, there was no other preparation of the bodies to preserve the organs or anything like that. It was just, we're going to honor our dead by sinking them in the water, and just a cultural thing, I believe.
Don't you find that interesting?
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't know of any other culture that's deliberately done that. Do you?
Not that I've discovered in reading.
Now, there's been no tablets, inscriptions, I mean, no stone stuff. Obviously, wood would not have survived. Well, maybe if you buried wood in the bog, it would, you know, with incised, you know, hieroglyphs or whatever, it might survive, right?
Mm-hmm.
But nothing like that's been found.
Well, actually, I spoke with the person that was in charge of the that was in, not spoke with him. I listened to a lecture by the person in charge of the Topper excavation in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
That after they dug through and found one. The civilization, then they went even farther and found, and it's ancient tools, 20,000 years old or something like that. And when he was talking to us at his lecture, he mentioned that he could go and find plenty more of these bog bodies and of these people, but the North American Grave Reparations Act, or it's an act of Congress, mm-hmm. that does not allow the exhumation of ancient remains. But he said if he was given the opportunity to be able to go out and find these and find more bodies and more evidence of
I thought that because I remember the Congressional Act, and it's been very operative in returning remains, like I think Kennewick Man or something, to current Native American tribes and all that.
Correct.
But if you're dealing with a culture that's been gone, it's, you know, 7,000-8,000 years old, there's no surviving, you know, group to claim the legacy, and we get between the boundary of human relations and archaeology. You mean they are prohibited from actually looking for more ancient remains and evidence because of this act of Congress?
Yes.
That's stunning.
They're because what he mentioned was that if he does go, the instant he finds it, he has to tell somebody. And mm-hmm. they're not going to go and try to find the Timaquan or the Calusa, because they no longer are around. They're going to go to the Seminoles and ask them, and ask the local tribe what to be done with the bones, mm-hmm. with the burial. And even if they don't have anything to do with them, even if they're of a different age,
well, wait a minute. What
or
if,
DNA.
Exactly. What if they did a DNA test and show there's no relationship? How under the law could they then claim ownership?
They don't do that. They don't do the DNA testing.
Why not?
They just contact the local tribe and try to take care of it and find out what they want done with the burials.
Hmm. Sounds kind of loosey-goosey to me.
That was my thought. Now, I have the utmost respect. I would imagine that the utmost respect should be shown for all remains.
Well, yeah, I mean, when folks were plundering the Middle East and, you know, raising the tells and finding all kinds of stuff, in that era, you know, the robber baron era, nobody gave a damn. Now we're a little more conscious. There are ways, I imagine, one could do this and satisfy everybody, but you got to have a conversation, and you have to apply science, and you have to show that this so predates the current tribes or the current, you know, out here we call them Pueblos, that there's no relationship. And if you do the DNA test, which is really cheap these days, you could conclusively define and prove that there was no cultural connection. Therefore, there's nobody to return to anybody.
Yes, but that raises the possibility of the current people living on the land not having a claim
to the land.
To that land.
Hmm.
And you've given them a reservation, and, you know, you've provided them the opportunity to live there. If you can show that somebody else was there previously,
mm-hmm.
it would weaken their claim. and
oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we anyway.
Yes.
Okay, so you're looking at all this stuff. You're beginning to take your great grandfather's work seriously, at least part of it. At some point, you made this really gravitas decision. I'm going to write a book about this. And having written a few books, that's not a trivial decision. So, Jack, when did you decide to write the book, Lifting the Veil on the Lost Continent?
What I did is I was – the purpose of me writing that book was to go through – and it was for my own personal research, was to go through and look at each of the authors that he quoted, and the texts that he quoted, and his sources, to look at his sources to see if they had any bearing to reality.
Okay.
And my purpose, and I worked for years on just trying to look at all the different sources and consulting other books and whatnot, and I put them down as notes in the same book as his text. And one day my wife said to me, "What are you doing with that? why don't you see if it'll be published? I don't think anybody will read it." And so
She said nobody would read it?
Nobody would read it, yes.
Hmm. So very supportive, Jack. Very.
Well, I mean, she's got to keep my feet on the ground.
So you found that being an author is also a lonely position, a lonely profession.
Sometimes, yes.
Hold it there. We have a break here at the top of the hour. My guest this morning on The Other Side of Midnight is Jack Churchwood. We're discussing his great-granddad's interesting and, in a very punny way, seminal research. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return from the Land of Enchantment on Saturday morning. Stay tuned. And we are back on The Other Side of Midnight. Jack Churchwood is our spellbinding guest. We had a really interesting question in the break. My producer broke into my ears and said, "What about the DNA related to people who are living today? Has anybody looked at that?" Jack, you want to take a whack at that?
Well, actually, they took the samples of the people in the Wendover Bog. That they did take their DNA, and it was not... from what I understand, it's not related to anyone currently living in America.
Wow. That's really fascinating.
And it was original reports were that it was unique, that they couldn't find any relatives of them, which I really didn't some of that I didn't really believe. There has to be somebody related to them somewhere.
Well, when you say in the United States or in the continent, what about looking beyond? I mean, your great-grandfather's idea, his model was that there was this progenitor civilization. Would that be a fair assessment?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they then spread all over the world.
Correct.
What about people in Asia, in New Zealand, the Maori, the folks on the western side of South America, the folks up in China? Have they compared the DNA to all of these other peoples and found no matches?
From what I understand, those were the specific.
That's crazy. That's totally crazy, and I'm with you. I don't believe it. Do not believe that. So, why would somebody be covering up links that we would suspect might be there? Or don't you want to go there?
There is speculation that it's European DNA.
I actually saw... I saw something, was it on Discover, Travel Channel, whatever, that there was a potential linkage, now that you're jogging my memory, to Europeans.
And that's a real no-no.
Oh, yeah. Because that would mean Columbus, you know, is a newbie.
Exactly.
Okay, so you're writing this book. Your wife says, "Ah, come on." Like a million writers, you know, wives say, "Ah, come on. It's never going to be published. No one's going to read it." But you, Jack, said, "I got to get this thing out there." What made you do that?
Well, I just took my Word file, created a PDF, and chopped some samples out of it and sent it to some publishers.
Wow. Good for you.
And they said, sure thing,
wow.
Ozark Mountain Publishing.
Which publisher?
Ozark Mountain Publishing, the late Dolores Cannon's.
Oh, that opens up another whole window on this conversation. So they saw something in your work. Obviously, they were familiar with Churchward, right? The original?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, all right, let's get to the nubbin. By the way, there is a link in your bio, Lifting the Veil on the Lost Continent of Mu, Motherland of Men. That's provocative. So what's your salient point bringing 21st century techniques, your technical background, your experience to the age-old problem? What did James Churchward find, and when did he find it?
That's essentially what I was doing, yes. And
okay.
evaluating his writing and provide the opportunity for other people to look at my research and make up their own minds. I don't come to any conclusions. I didn't put my thoughts in there whatsoever.
Oh, how did you resist?
I want to allow individuals to make up their own mind. I don't want to tell them how to think. If you pick up one of my books or read anything that I write, I might make some suggestions in there, but ultimately it's up to the individual reading it to make up their mind either whether or not they believe me or they what was written.
Okay, so your grandfather's work was published in the 20s, I think, what, 26?
And the first book was 1926, yes.
Okay, and yours was 2011.
Correct.
So how did you encapsulate his work from a modern perspective?
Well, essentially what I did is I added three appendices. One covers the people he references, gives a little background information on who they were and what they wrote. And another appendix was the quoted text. If he quoted a text or something in the book, I went out and did my best to try to find the original so that you could read both of them side by side to see if he doctored it or whatever.
And what was your conclusion?
My conclusion is that he borrowed an awful lot from Le Plongeon. He also had a few things from his brother, Albert Churchward, who was he wrote books on Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at his facts or what he proposed as facts and just made suggestions and notes about what I thought of them. Well, but what I found in my research. And I provided references back to that.
Okay. I guess I'm kind of, I don't know where to go here, because if I had a very famous great-grandfather and I kind of delved into what he was proposing, one of the things that I would not be held back from is independently trying to see if what his thesis was supported by modern data.
And essentially, that's what I did.
Oh, okay. So let's get to the nubbin then. What did you find of his theories of an ancient, advanced culture on this planet circa 12,000, 13,000 years ago that would hold up to the light of day? Given that we're on the other side of midnight.
You can hear the crickets because I really haven't found anything in his books. For instance, he names all the Pacific Island megaliths and suggests that those are from the ancient colonies of Mu.
Are we talking the heads on Easter Island, for instance?
Correct.
Okay.
And or Pohnpei. That the magical city that they built out of granite in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those
are these the ruins that kind of look like jackstraws?
Yes.
Tons and tons of long tabular, almost like girders, about the same size, except they're made out of stone. They're not made out of steel.
Right, and they built an island and a little city out there. But those are known. I mean, the people that built those are known. I mean, I understand that some individuals will be happy to say and tell you one side of the story that, no, you can't move those because we don't have the wherewithal to be able to do it today. And they'll tell you that they used sonic power or they used alien technologies. But the granite that they're using comes from the other side of the island.
Mm-hmm.
I watched a TV show a couple of years ago that showed how they could put one of those on a reed raft and move it right down the coastline and move it to wherever they wanted.
Hmm. Okay. So that was one of the cornerstones of your great-grandfather's theses, and you believe there's an alternative explanation that does not involve an ancient continent, an ancient people, an ancient advanced culture.
Yes.
Okay. So after the first, how did your first book do? As one writer to another, how'd your book do?
Well, I'm still working.
You're working at your day job?
Yes.
Okay.
It didn't make any bestseller lists.
Okay. So, having that experience, you embark on book number two, called The Stone Tablets of Mu. This is kind of where I will very tangentially enter the story, because when I became a producer on a sci-fi special around 2012, and we all went to Teotihuacan, one of the things that I went looking for was the stone tablets ostensibly found by a guy named William Niven.
Yes, and that's what the book's about.
Yeah, and I really, really try. I wish I'd known about your book then. Probably would have saved me a lot of trouble. What is your conclusion about these remarkable tablets? And for those who don't know what we're talking about, kind of set the scene. Who was William Niven? What was the story of the tablets? How old were they? Where were they found? How deep? All those cool questions.
Well, I'd go and tell a little bit about Mr. Niven. He came from Scotland, moved to the United States, became a miner almost within the next year in New Mexico, and obviously knew what he was doing. He entered an agreement with an individual who owned the rights to the Petrified Forest.
You mean out near the Grand Canyon?
Correct.
Oh, okay. West of the Grand Canyon, there's an amazing place, the Petrified Forest. It's a stunning place to visit. Everybody who can get there. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience, really.
Well, they entered into business together and opened up a storefront in New York. After a period of time, the other guy left. But William Niven stayed there to sell his gems and the minerals that he had found. And he was, since there was a lot of construction going on.
This is Mexico City, right?
No, New York City.
Oh, I'm sorry, New York. Why did I say,
and
oh, we're
since
get
there
to
were a lot of building going on, he showed and sold these to go and find galenite in a, I believe that's what it's called, in Texas.
Wasn't galenite used in crystal radios?
I'm not sure. He was tasked by Thomas Edison to go and find it as a filament for the electric light bulb.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But he eventually moved on and went to Mexico. They were doing some mining down there. And he went to see the governor of one of the states. And
we're talking William Niven, just so everybody keeps in mind. Because I'm waiting for the connection to your great-grandfather.
All righty. And on his way from seeing some relics that the governor had collected, he went through this area, and he said it was 2 square miles or 20 square miles of ruins. and he went through them, and I guess that's when he caught his archaeology bug. Now, that was in the 1870s and 1880s, and if you fast forward to 1910 and 11, he moved and started a storefront in Mexico City, selling the artifacts that he was finding.
In this 2 square miles of ruins?
No, actually, he had moved, like I said, fast forward. He had found a spot near Mexico City. Then he was able to ride the train there and negotiate with farmers to dig in their yards and their fields, mm-hmm. and pull these things out.
Okay.
So 30 feet below the surface, he was finding artifacts. Actually, 3 levels of civilizations 30 feet down. And my great-grandfather picked up on that and included an entire story in his book, The Lost Khanhunu, Motherland of Men, mm-hmm. and included an article written by William Niven about these discoveries that he'd found. And James likened it to the Lost Continent of Mu, that this was just one of the colonies.
Okay.
After that book was out and Mr. Niven saw it, because they hadn't been in communication, they started a communication. And James was the recipient of some 2,500 of the 2,600 tablets that Niven found.
Oh, my gosh.
Or images of them.
So he actually took photographs of these things?
He took photographs and etchings.
Did he take photographs of the excavations, the process of actually digging them out of the ground?
Yes. So one of the most famous, the tablet number 1, or is it tablet number 4? It's a altar stone, was watched by two archaeologists from the Carnegie Museum coming out of the ground. They saw the roots still on it and everything.
Can't get more mainstream than that.
No, and all these were found, and all these are known.
Okay, let me ask you this question. 30 feet, do you remember what roughly that translates to in age?
There's been a lot of estimations. Some people said it was very, very old, 100,000 years old. Some of them said it was 40,000. Some said it was, and there were, it's mentioned in the book, all the different media that took on the issue of trying to date the tablets.
So we moved a while ago, and I have a big house and a big library. I went through every single book in our library this evening looking for Tompkins' Secrets of the Mexican Pyramids, because in there is a profile of the Niven timeline with showing the various strata and showing
really?
That there were apparently periods of catastrophic floods indicating mm-hmm. some major cataclysm that had covered and buried these things. I remember that. By the way, I could not find that book. Someone's wandered off with my Secrets of the Mexican Pyramids. Please bring it back. Anyway, but that to me, the 100,000-year timeline, when you account for the cobbles and the rubble, in other words, the column, the stratigraphic column, was very weird compared to standard stratigraphy in other places that this miner was familiar with. And that's why I was really asking you about the age, because that gets into the territory. If there was a continent, if there was a cataclysm, you'd find at the shores, you know, huge tsunamis creating this kind of till that Niven could have dug through.
Well, this also... all these discoveries were in the Valley of Mexico.
Mm, the Valley of the Sun, right?
I believe so. And the rise of the mountains occurred after this, so that was one of the theories that James had about the destruction of their civilization.
But the cataclysm, as you said before, had caused the rise of the mountains, the Andes.
And the sinking of Mu and Atlantis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which, by the way, really would mess up the standard uniformitarianism model of the stratigraphic column.
Probably. But in 1927, James took some images that Mr. Niven had sent to him and created a book for his publisher. And it was called Copies of Stone Tablets Found by William Niven Near Santiago Ahuizacla, Near Mexico City.
They never heard the idea of one line or one word title.
Yes, that's true. I know that well now that I've named a book Lifting the Veil and the Lost Motherland of Man. I will not
do
that again.
Hey, it's in your DNA. Come on, Jack.
It appears. But the Stone Tablets of Mu is what I did as I looked at Niven's life and James' life and the stories around these 36 tablets that were included in this book. This book it's been in a library archive, hidden away for 70, 80 years.
Whose library?
University of Berkeley.
Just down the street from where I used to live.
And I believe that's where it is, University of California at Berkeley.
And there's only one copy?
Well, if you buy my book, you can have a copy.
I mean, no, I'm talking about the classic, the one your great-grandfather wrote.
Right, he only made one copy.
Oh, my gosh.
And gave it to his publisher for Christmas, 1927.
Why didn't he publish it?
It's only like 40 pages.
Oh, it's like a monograph.
Correct.
Okay.
And so I added to it and showed how the tablets were used in the book in his subsequent work, and how his work changed after he got in touch with Mr. Niven.
What do you mean it changed?
Well, for instance, in the first book, Lifting the on the Lost Continent of Mu, Motherland of Men, which was in 1926, mm-hmm. has three pictures of Niven's tablets, and I believe one or two of them, none of them are numbered, but one or two are, he deciphers them, interprets them. If you fast forward to 1931, we've got the Lost Continent of Mu re-released, and he's got 69 of the tablets in it.
Okay, this is because in the interim, Niven got hold of him.
Niven got hold of him, but also he was accused of fraud when he used only the Nicol tablets. That nobody else had seen them, and nobody had claimed to see them. And he was the only one, so they all poo-pooed it and said, it's not worth it. We're not even going to look at your stuff. And so when he came out in 1931, he used Niven's tablets and his interpretations and link to the Nicol tablets mm-hmm. as another pillar in his building a reputation of, building his theory.
So he was building a case.
Correct.
Now, were the inscriptions the same?
He mentioned that they were. Now, he mentions that some of them were, and I don't know, some of these things I don't understand. Like, for instance, he said some of them were from the Uyghur Maya, and he used other peoples that he thought were neighboring them on Mu before they moved. But whether or not he could tell what they were, I don't know.
Well, the techniques for, doing forensic analysis of, I mean, you really can't do much with stone. You can't even date stone. So you have to look at the epigraphy in terms of the language, in terms of how did he even begin to translate them? Did they have any known associations with known languages?
Well, his thought was that they looked like the Nicol tablets he saw in India many, many years previously, and that he had been taught how to decipher them. That's what he wrote.
Okay.
Now, another archaeologist wrote that he thought that the tablets represented the beginnings of the Mayan glyphs and the beginning of their alphabet and being able to communicate in a written form.
That's not trivial.
No. But another reason I wrote this is, well, for one reason, nobody had seen the book. So now everybody can, if they want, can look at what he wrote. and read a little bit more background about it and how he used the tablets.
You mean what your grandfather wrote, great-grandfather wrote? I keep doing that all night tonight, huh? Okay, here's the big question. What happened to the tablets?
That's, well, see, they haven't been studied. From what I've read, I've queried people. I've even queried the Mexican government. And nobody has studied them. And I believe that's because my great-grandfather deciphered them, and they weren't going to touch it with a 10-foot pole to avoid ending their careers.
But oh, so you mean the knowledge filter around your great-granddad's rep has kept scholarship from actually looking at potentially a stunning breakthrough in the origin of the Mayan script, the origin of the Maya themselves, the origin of transmigrations of peoples all over the planet. Just because they didn't like your great-grandfather, they haven't looked at the tablets?
I believe that's the case, yes.
So where are the tablets?
Well, that's a funny story in that...
We have time. Come on, tell us the funny story.
My great-grandfather's adopted nephew.
Okay, let me track this carefully. Your great-grandfather's adopted nephew...
And his name slips my recognition right now, but...
It'll come back to you. Just keep going. It'll come.
He was contacted by some government agency from Mexico.
At what time frame? What time frame is this?
In the late 1970s.
Oh.
75, 76 or so.
Okay.
And they wrote him very pointedly, sent like three or four letters, rapid fire, to ask him where the information it was about that my great-grandfather had about the tablets.
Mm-hmm.
Because his uncle or his nephew was given the rights to his publishing his books, and they contacted him through the publisher of the books.
Was that because the rest of the family kind of didn't want to have anything to do with him?
Absolutely.
Okay.
No member of my family gets a penny from the publication of his books.
Wouldn't it be incredibly ironic, Jack, if he's ultimately proved right and there's millions and millions and millions and they don't get a penny?
Well, that's me now. I'm an only son.
Oh, you're the only survivor.
Well, I've got a sister.
Okay.
But, yes. So he was finally, I believe, they tried to meet with him at the consulate.
These are government G-men in the 1970s.
From Mexico.
Oh, from the government of Mexico?
Yes.
Oh, I thought it was the U.S. government.
No.
Okay,
Mexican government were writing him letters, and I've got copies of them, and I've written to the Mexican government to inquire whether or not they found them or anything. And then I was reading the Niven's biography, Buried Cities, Forgotten Gods. And in it, he mentions, his grandson mentions, that they were buried in a neighborhood in Veracruz, after the Mexican government decided not to give him permission to bring them back to Texas.
I kind of remember this part of the story. It's been so long ago since we did all that stuff for that special. It was 2009, I think, we taped everything. But this does ring a bell that we were actually on the trail looking for the archives themselves of the tablets.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear more about it. But some of them are in Harvard. In a museum in Harvard.
You mean the Peabody Museum has actually got physical tablets from Niven?
I believe so, if not some of the artifacts that he sold in his storefront. And there are also some in private collections.
So why haven't you beaten down the door with Peabody to find out where the damn tablets are?
Because they probably only have a few.
It only takes one white crow. If there's a chain of custody, if you can prove this was Niven / Church Ward's tablets, you only got to find one or two of them to have a really interesting discussion.
Mm-hmm. I've got pictures.
But you haven't seen and touched the tablets.
That's true.
Hmm. Now, did Harvard send you pictures of them?
Negative.
Oh.
I haven't been in contact with them.
Oh. Well, where'd you get the pictures?
The pictures are, James included in his books.
Okay.
And there are some in Buried Cities, Forgotten Gods that was written by the grandson of William Niven.
Hmm. Okay. This is absolutely fascinating. And on that note, hold it right there. We'll come back with the rest of the story right after the break. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. You're on the other side of midnight. We're talking to Jack Churchward this morning, and it looks like there's actually solid, hard evidence that something his great-grandfather wrote about actually can be traced down and verified. That is, if someone actually wants to trace them down and verify them. We shall return. Back on the other side of midnight, my guest this morning, Jack Churchward, we're discussing his great-grandfather's work, his research, the fact that Jack has been impelled, even against, shall we say, gentle family inclinations, to publish or perish, and he's now got two books out there. Are you working on a third?
Yes, sir.
Ah, of course, you have to. You're a writer. Yeah. And someday, you're going to be able to quit your day job. You just keep at this. I'm telling you, it will work. I want to bring on Scott, my producer, because Scott had an amazingly important question. And rather than take credit for it, I'd like to introduce Scott. Scott, why don't you ask Jack your really intriguing question?
Well, during the break, I piped into you guys saying I'm like a school kid squirming in my chair, arms waving frantically with questions. But the one that intrigues me are the tablets and the etched symbols. And I think you mentioned close to half a dozen far-flung precincts around the globe that people back then looked at these etchings when they would discover the tablets and said, well, it looks a lot like that place, or it looks a lot like that place in India, Mexico. And so go with that, because that, I'm on the edge of my chair with it.
Well, his discoveries down underneath in the fields and whatnot in the Valley of Mexico, he found, for instance, collapsed buildings with frescoes that the entire wall wasn't destroyed. He found an entire frescoes that he said matched those of Babylonia or any of those, the Greeks or the Romans. He also mentioned that he found a goldsmith's workshop, and that the size of the work was tiny, and that was, you know, obviously someone today would say we couldn't do it today, but we obviously could. And other things he found were, for instance, statues and figurines of people from Asia. He said that there were pictures, and he, in his terms, Hindus and Arabs and even people from Africa.
Now, is this James Churchward quoting Niven, or is this Niven himself?
This was James quoting Niven.
Okay.
And Niven's article. I include the article that James quotes in his books in the Stone Tablets of Mu and the Lifting the Veil on the Lost Continent of Mu, Motherland of Men, so that the reader has the opportunity to compare the two versions.
See, when we, in I think 2009, Robin and I went down to Teotihuacan as part of this NBC crew, we didn't have anywhere near the time to actually dig into this, but my big question then is still is now, where did all these artifacts of an obvious ancient Mayan pre-Incan culture, where do they all go?
Well, I guess they're in the National Museum.
They're in Mexico City.
Correct.
Oh.
boxed up maybe in a warehouse somewhere?
But you don't know, we're talking Indiana Jones warehouse?
I don't know about that, maybe.
Hmm.
But, for instance, I mentioned about the government officials that came over and inquired about James' nephew.
See, it sounds to me like they don't know either, and they're trying to track down through church wards himself or his relatives or, you know.
Exactly. And that, I you know, eventually somebody will come across where they buried the crates. They were all hand-packed and wrapped and taken care of, but I don't know if they were in wooden boxes, how long they'd last. But then again, there are stone, hard stone tablets, so they probably won't.
Yeah, I mean, the crates could corrode and erode and dissipate, and the stone tablets would be there. I mean, they'd be there for thousands of years, if not longer, in terms of the model, right?
Absolutely.
But it's interesting how all... We were talking to Michael Cremo the other night. I'm sure you know who Michael Cremo is, even if you've never met. And we're discussing how all this cool stuff seems to just disappear over and over and over again, like someone has taken a giant cultural vacuum cleaner to our real history, and we've been fed this pablum, this script, this pre-digested, you know, Victorian unending progress from the cave to, you know, the space station, and that's not really our history at all. And every time we get a breakthrough, someone like your great-grandfather and the folks he knew, somehow mysteriously the actual evidence just disappears.
I will agree. He's got, though, there's about almost 200 of the pictures. I mean, 200 of the illustrations of Niven's tablets that are contained in his books.
Okay, so in your book, Stone Tablets of Mu, that's the title, right?
Correct.
Nice and short, pithy. You're learning.
Yes.
What is your conclusion?
My conclusion is that a lot of people thought that he was all crazy and wouldn't even touch the tablets that Niven had found.
That's amazing.
Research to find out where they were, how their civilization, to find out what they meant or anything about them because of the association with my great-grandfather.
This is so parallel to a story that Cremo told us the other night here on Other Side of Midnight. He said in the last, I guess, two or three years, there's been a major archaeological find in Africa of bones, finger bones, found under datable lava at 1.8 million years or something that are totally, totally, totally modern finger bones, which, of course, completely would upset our entire reconstruction of the lineage of Homo sapiens and the precursors, Homo erectus and all those other guys, and that the folks writing the papers have actually taken that evidence and bent it in their minds into a model that supports a much more ancient, primitive anthropoid and completely tosses out the fact that all the analyses say this is a modern finger bone or set of finger bones in a place where they couldn't have been intrusive burials, they couldn't have been, you know, hoaxes, they could have been snuck in. In other words, the data completely upsets the standard model, and the data has been systematically and religiously, and I don't use that term lightly, ignored because it would violate the current model.
Well, I'm not sure that everybody is in on the plot to maintain the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
But because I know myself, I believe that I'm a rational individual and I'm able to make rational decisions. I don't believe everything my great-grandfather wrote, and yet some of it rings true.
It only takes one white crow to prove all crows aren't black.
Mm-hmm.
And you found, I mean, to me, when I found this story, and that's why I took the crew down there to try to track down these tablets, of all the things that your great-grandfather had written about, to me, the tablets were the most extraordinary because if they can be located, and if the excavations can be located, we can do the stratigraphy, that set of data alone could overturn the standard model of a whole bunch of stuff.
Well, unfortunately, we would not be able to repeat it, at least not easily. The areas where Niven was excavating at the time was farmland, but now it's paved. It's paved over and people live there. Mm-hmm. It's one of the suburbs of Mexico City.
But if it was a culture as extensive as was hinted at, wouldn't there be other places where you would find pristine land? You could actually do ground-penetrating radar, trenches. There's all kinds of new modern techniques. For instance, you could use satellite imagery, like they found new pyramids in Egypt based on satellite data. You could look down and see if there's geometry, you know, the architectural mm-hmm. geometry of a major civilization. You can't have just one little campfire with a bunch of statues, and that's all there is.
Right. Well, I imagine that could possibly happen, but it's a very densely populated area now.
Mm-hmm.
But I imagine that if an individual took it upon themselves to start digging in their backyard and opened themselves up a pit and kept going down and hopefully the dirt wouldn't fall in on top of them or anything and hurt them, but they could perhaps find things, and it's probably been done quite a bit anyway.
But if it was done, let's say by, you know, under what would you call that, kind of off the books archaeology, and then things show up in museums because they're being sold, there's no point in doing that because you'd have to date and claim the history to make an object like that worthwhile putting on display. You wouldn't buy it to keep it in the basement unless you were buying it to keep it in the basement to keep it covered up so no one else knew it was around.
That's one way to do it. I agree.
Okay, so let's get to the next interesting question, which is, what's your next book?
My next book, I am looking at the Great Uyghur Empire, as my great-grandfather wrote about it.
Okay.
He wrote that in Asia, 70,000 years ago, the first colonists, that was the primary, as James wrote, it was the primary colony.
From Mu.
From Mu. And they went to Asia and started it.
What part of Asia?
Mongolia.
The plateau.
Gobi Desert now.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, all his stuff doesn't really match very closely, but there are some parallels to the Great Uyghur Empire or the Great Uyghur Khaganate of the 8th century, as opposed to the earlier one that James says was wiped out by the magnetic cataclysm.
At 12,000, 13,000.
Correct.
So how do you pursue from Florida research in Mongolia, which not only is physically interesting to get to, but there's some kind of political problems in the way?
I have some Uyghur friends.
Really? Oh.
Yes.
Okay.
And some Mongolian friends as well.
And we have the internet.
Absolutely.
Amazing what that technology is doing, isn't it? We are being heard all over the planet. This show could be heard by your friends right now, or they could go to Club 19.5 and listen to the archive. That's how connected we are now. So you somehow connect. How did you connect to halfway world around the world? Even if the internet exists, you got to know who to talk to. How did you wind up being connected?
This might be political.
So, be as general as you need to be then.
Okay. In 1993, the Chinese government came and opened up a propaganda theme park 2 miles from Walt Disney World. They put on exhibits they showed that His Holiness the Dalai Lama's Patala Palace as Chinese. And they showed that several Uyghur structures were Chinese and gave them Chinese names, and they showed what they had done to.
When you say they show, you mean they claim that show means in technical academies they actually have evidence.
They put up displays and the exhibit sign in front of the display.
Oh, so they presented the idea.
Correct.
Okay.
They also took the mausoleum of Genghis Khan, as they call it, and said, notice that he was Chinese as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I was involved with some Tibetan friends, and they went to start protesting there, and we started protesting there as well. And I would write them a letter and tell them that we would stop protesting if they would just negotiate with us to change the sign to tell the truth, because the Potala Palace was the home of subsequent Dalai Lamas since the fifth Dalai Lama.
Mm-hmm.
Which goes back how many years?
I just drew a blank. At least 400 or 500 years, okay. At least.
Okay.
And it's outrageous that they would prove, you know, to try to show to the world how these people who, I mean, for instance, the Uyghur people from eastern Turkestan, who they had exhibits. If you look at their population and compare it to the population statistics around the world, there are more population than 137 other countries or nations, yet they're treated as a minority in China. And their culture, their language is being eradicated. And so
it's a very similar sad story all over the world.
And I and some friends took upon this task, and after the Chinese government called up my house and threatened my son's life, we decided that perhaps we wouldn't be doing politics anymore. And I went on to study my great-grandfather.
Now, did you come at this from the people there, or did you come at it from your grandfather's work and then connect it because you were already in touch with these people?
Well, that when I had finished the protest demonstrations and the theme park closed and they called and threatened us, I was approached by one Uyghur gentleman who had taken it upon himself to translate the Lost Khanate of Mu into Uyghur.
Oh.
And he handed me a copy and he said, "Do you know about the Great Uyghur Empire?" Well, I had been studying the history of the Great Uyghur Empire from the 8th century in Asia, and they were in Mongolia and finally moved westward after they were attacked by the Kazakhs. But I knew, I had been reading about their history, and I, you know, and putting it on our website so that people would understand it and to realize that they weren't Chinese since ancient times as they had were telling everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Nope, that's not the one I'm talking about. I'm talking about the one in the book."
Mm.
And so that was another reason for me to try to figure things out. And it has a lot of advocates today, the Great Uyghur Empire, among many Turkic writers, Turkish also,
mm-hmm.
about their links to the Great Uyghur Empire that my great-grandfather wrote about. And I've been trying to find out from them, okay, this is what my great-grandfather wrote. What other information do you have? And unfortunately, I have gotten very little information from them about the subject. Other than, yeah, they point to my great-grandfather's work and say, "See what he said?"
So why are they being reticent?
I don't have the slightest idea. Maybe it's the language barrier.
Okay.
But I've asked, and it was studied by Ataturk and Maya Tepik, one of his individuals that was sent to be an ambassador to Mexico. He saw the Niven's discoveries and found out about my great-grandfather's things and took that back to Ataturk. And from what I understand, Ataturk had there's a whole section of my the study of my great-grandfather's books over in Turkey. But I guess it's not open to the public.
So if your great-grandfather had access to sources, that we're able to tell him information enough so we could actually write the book. How come you can't replicate the sources, or with modern techniques, the internet, you know, the ability to cross-correlate, the ability to translate them, there's ways to get translations. Why is there this impediment, or is the Chinese kind of hanging in the wings as a deterrent to any progress at that end?
I haven't approached it in that way. What I've done is I've tried to ask them. I've got one source document that kind of matches the description of the Great Uyghur Empire that James provides in like three or four of his books. I've got one of the source documents that was contained in his scrapbook, in one of the scrapbooks, and I placed that also in Lifting the Veil on the Lost Continent of Mu, so that people can see, you know, again, what the difference was between this one piece of source material and what he wrote.
Would a personal visit help? An on-site visit?
Where would you suggest?
Well, I'm talking about that part of the world. I mean, if you want to find out the evidence of an ancient culture, sometimes it's nice to be on the ground to see if the ancient culture left stuff that you can... In other words, person-to-person contact, notwithstanding the internet, is still the best way to negotiate with people and them to get to know you and you to get to know them and trust to be established. I mean, it sounds to me like it's a level of trust here.
Well, absolute. Actually, I'm not sure that I'd be allowed to go there.
But they, you don't know until you ask.
Well, they were pretty upset that I put their $300 million theme park out of business.
Okay, well, I guess that would... But things change. I mean, you know, politics is evanescent. You know, what's that old cliche, a year in politics is a lifetime?
Well, I have been tracking their malware since 2002, and they're still sending it.
Mm-hmm. The reason I say this is because I don't know whether you know anything about our research, but we've been looking at ancient ruins all over the solar system. Yes, there are ancient ruins all over the solar system, a lot older than your great-grandfather would ever have imagined. And in the last 2 years, since 2013, the Chinese sent Chang 3 and the little robot, the little rover, Jade Rabbit, and they've landed on the moon in Mare Imbrium, which is where the Apollo program never went. They took stunning color imagery with Doth spacecraft, and those images confirm what the Apollo guys photographed in terms of ancient ruins on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And they published them in the official website of the Chinese People's, you know, Republic Army.
Xinhua?
Yeah. And I can give you the links, and you'll go and see the actual imagery, and bingo, they confirm what all the Apollo hoaxers claim never happened, that we never went to the moon and all that. So you've got a different government, different political structure, different generation, different technology, and it's stunningly confirming what NASA's been sitting on for 50 years. So it seems to me that there's, in other words, like, and I hate to quote this guy, Donald Trump, but you can negotiate anything. Find the levers to negotiate for the history of the human species. Somehow give the Chinese some credit for helping you dig it out, and you might find doors open.
Okay.
Just a thought.
Yes.
So we got about 3 or 4 minutes left. Besides this book, which appears to have a lot of closed doors to, I mean, how can you write a book if you only have one document? What else are you pursuing that might shed more light on your great-grandfather's really important idea, which is we are not the first?
Well, I have started a website where I'm putting down and showing images of each of the tablets that James shows in his books.
Oh, cool.
So that everybody, and they go out a couple times a week.
Is that called jack.churchward.com?
That is my personal website, but if you go to the links at the top there, one of those is Niven's Tablets Discoveries. There's a little icon probably halfway down the page or so.
Well, I know what I'm going to be doing after the show.
And I've got about, I believe, 70 so far already out there.
Oh, my. So all you epigraphers out in the audience, take a look, and if you recognize the language, if you see any affinities and affiliates or anything, by all means, drop us a line. You can find our contact info in the upper right-hand side of othersideofmidnight.com. And you're also pursuing the Niven tablets to see if you can find where those crates are buried.
That would be very helpful. But actually, I wanted to take the opportunity so that, as you said, any individual who might recognize anything on these tablets to actually put a comment in and tell me what it is.
Oh, cool. We have literally, Jack, a worldwide audience. We have people coming in to it from South Africa, from Hong Kong, from Bob is raising his hand over there, from Japan. We could have people in Mongolia listening to you right now.
Excellent. Signed by no.
Well, I certainly want to thank you. This has been a remarkable conversation. I think it's the beginning of something. I wish I'd read your book. Well, you published your book in 2014?
Correct.
On the tablets? See, we took the folks down there in 2009, so I couldn't quite well read your book because it didn't exist yet, but it would have been very, very helpful. And maybe if we take somebody down there again, you know, I would love to find something solid. There's been so much discussion over so many years of ancient cultures, ancient civilizations, and it always hangs out there in the ether or the torsion field as kind of gray, not black, not white, like it's up to everybody to make their own decision. Obviously, you started at one end of the spectrum, and the evidence, the data, has moved you very far in the direction of your great-grandfather's thesis, which is, we're not the first.
Yes. But I can't say that I've used all his evidence to show that. I've actually, you know, there's other things that I've discovered and seen that aren't explained by the engineering training that I received.
Well, unfortunately, we reached the end of the show. We reached the end of another week. Everyone, we'll see you same time, same station on Monday night, Tuesday morning. In the meantime, this is your host, Richard C. Hoagland, on the other side of midnight. And remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning.